And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're about a week and a half away from Election Day in Ohio, and the two candidates for Cincinnati mayor faced off in their final televised debate on Thursday night, last night. Hamilton County Clerk of Courts Aftab Purival and City Councilman David Mann met here in our building for the event. It was a collaboration between WCET-TV and WVXU, as well as the Cincinnati Chamber. So what did they have to say to each other and the voters in the waning days of this campaign? WVXU local government reporter and fellow television star Becca Costello was on the panel posing questions to the candidates and is in the studio with me now. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Michael.
I have to say, I don't know how Marianne Zalesnik, our boss here, expected us to show up today after the star treatment we got downstairs ahead of our TV debut. Yeah. We had makeup. We had craft services. It was really fun. But of course, there was work to do. And
that's
that work
right.
involved the final televised debate between the two candidates for Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purival and David Mann. So initial reaction to this, what do you think that these two candidates were trying to, I guess, nail down to the voters here? Did we learn anything new? Did you see any new tactics, or was it consistent messages from these pair?
I have to say it was pretty consistent messages. We didn't hear a lot new last night, which is a little disappointing, I think, for voters who are pretty tuned in and have watched some of the prior debates, seen their interviews, read their questionnaires, and are kind of familiar with their positions on things. Something a little bit unique last night, the candidates did get a chance to ask each other one question, and that kind of had some interesting results there.
It did.
So that was something we haven't seen at a debate so far. David Mann asked Aftab Purival if he would commit to fulfilling the term. Mann has really pushed this narrative that Purival has run for a lot of offices recently and that he's just using this as a stepping stone for higher office. But Purival did said he would absolutely proudly serve the full 4-year term if he's elected.
Now, let me correct you there, Becca, because
yes.
the way you put it was a lot more words than Aftab used. Okay, because I think the way it was set up, each candidate got to offer a question to the other, and then the candidate receiving the question would have 90 seconds to answer.
That's right.
And so, yeah, you're right that David Mann posed this question, characterized through his own campaign messaging that mm-hmm. Aftab runs for a lot of offices. He's not committed to serving his term as mayor. And what was Aftab's actual response?
His first response was, yes.
That's it.
Mann did push back a little bit, and Aftab did later say, yes, absolutely, proudly, I will serve. But his very simple answer was, yes, I will fulfill the term.
I thought it was interesting, the question that Aftab Purival posed to David Mann. And I should note, you were on the panel, of course, asking questions. I was the moderator, so mm-hmm. I was kind of, the referee of sorts between the candidates and the panelists. So we were both there within feet of these two. And I had not heard this, I guess, campaign tactic from Purival towards Mann on the campaign. Is this something that he had used before?
I had not seen it, although with as much coverage as is out there, it's definitely possible that it's been addressed before and I just missed it. But Purival did ask the question about when Mann was serving in Congress and supported the 1994 crime bill, which has since been heavily criticized, particularly among Democrats, as something that has been extremely detrimental to the African-American community, especially. And that was certainly heavily part of Aftab's question to Mann about that. As much as it may have been new to voters, it certainly didn't seem to be a surprise to David Mann, who had a pretty short and to the point answer to that question and said, you know, lots of folks at that time did support the crime bill. It was an effort of now President Joe Biden. He also, I thought, smartly pointed out that Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown, who supports Aftab Purival in the race, also voted for the 1994 crime bill, but then kind of reflected and said lots of us can look back on that vote now and see the consequences that, you know, we didn't necessarily know then, and I would have voted differently at that time. So Mann didn't seem surprised by that question.
Yeah, I guess he may have been asked that question before in some other context, but yes, David Mann served in the United States Congress for one term. It included that 1994 session, and what's interesting is that this was an issue that arose during the 2020 Democratic presidential primary, mm-hmm. because Aftab Purival and David Mann are both Democrats.
Correct.
And in 1994, this crime bill was pushed by a Democratic president, Bill mm-hmm. Clinton. It was authored by a man who happens to be the Democratic president now, Joe Biden. So I'm wondering if this exchange was reflective of what we might be seeing in some larger capacity across Democratic politics of more progressive Democrats taking on more traditional or older even Democrats.
Yes, and I think on a more local scale, it is also yet another example of David Mann kind of taking on the less progressive side of the Democratic Party and really kind of aiming for those more conservative and Republican votes in the city in an effort to kind of be a stark contrast to Aftab Pierville's more progressive stance on many issues.
Well, we have some sound from last night's debate between Aftab Pierville and David Mann. It was again hosted here by WCET-TV, WVXU in the Cincinnati Chamber. I was the moderator of this debate, and Arbecca Costello, who is with me now, was on the panel. So let's hear the first clip. We got several different sound bites, but we'll start with one from Aftab Pierville, Josh.
Because Cincinnati, despite the growth that we've seen in the short term, continues to be incredibly segregated. We are a segregated city. Segregated by race, segregated by wealth, and the economic downturns of both 2008 and most recently 2020 has shown us that our Black community disproportionately feels the brunt of that due to that segregation and due to that systemic racism. I've got a Black agenda, and it can be summed up with one word, ownership. We need to do everything we can as a city to encourage more Black ownership of homes, more Black ownership of neighborhoods, and more Black ownership of businesses. And I've got a plan for it, a comprehensive economic recovery plan that calls for continuing to invest in important partners who are doing the work of supporting Black-owned businesses and making sure that they have access to capital, like the Minority Business Accelerator at the Chamber, like the Urban League, and like the NAACP and the African American Chamber. But we have to do more than that. We have to make sure that diversity and inclusion is a priority in our city contracting, making sure that we lower the barriers to entry for Black-owned businesses to be vendors, not just in construction, but also professional services. And we've got to leverage the incredible strength we have in our Fortune 500s to partner with our local Black businesses so that we can find synergies and uplift everyone. Those are just three very specific examples of how we can do it, and there's even more in my plan.
Rebecca, you might have to refresh my memory here, but I believe that response was to a question posed by Raquel Howard Smith from the Urban League.
That's
about
right.
Violence, right? Wasn't it about like the root causes in Black communities of the violence, or was there something specific about racism and segregation?
I believe this was actually the first question of the debate, which had to do with the Black middle class and referencing some studies done both nationally and locally showing that Cincinnati has a much smaller Black middle class compared to comparable cities or similar sized cities across the country. And there was, though, a question later on that addressed some sort of similar issues of equity. And you know, when the question of violence came up, both David Mann and Aftab Pierville did both say that poverty is really one of the key issues when it comes to violence, that, you know, addressing poverty is a way to address violence.
Well, we heard from Aftab Pierville there answering that question. Let's hear Councilman David Mann's response to that question.
I would ask you to take a look at my record, particularly in recent years as chair of the Budget and Finance Committee. I'm so proud of the money we were able to devote to Black organizations devoted to improving the economic situation of Black businesses and citizens in our community. Something else that's really important that I'm proud of, some 80% of our large budget is managed by directors who are African-American. So the city of Cincinnati has achieved something great in terms of placing responsibility with Black employees.
And that was Councilman David Mann responding to that question as well. So when we look at where these candidates stand on Black issues, again, we didn't necessarily hear anything new from either candidate. I know that these have been issues raised since last year with the racial justice movement that certainly arrived in Cincinnati the way it had in cities across the country. But these are pretty consistent responses to these types of questions.
Yeah, not a lot new. And I think those two audio pieces we just heard are good kind of summaries or good examples of their positions on these. Mann even saying directly, look at my record, less specific about what he would like to do in the future and more, you know, look at what we've been able to accomplish over the last 8 years. He talks a lot about building on the momentum of the Cranley administration and moving ahead from there. Aftab Pierville himself has used the word equity, made that a really key part of his campaign, and mentioned a few specifics there. I think one of the potential weaknesses in that approach is Pierwald doesn't necessarily talk about how he's going to fund all of these ideas he has for equity. So some very specific ideas, but not necessarily specifics on what the top priority is among those. He's got a lot of big ideas, but I'm not entirely sure what we'd see on day one.
And that has been a criticism leveled from the Mann campaign, right? Like, mm-hmm. I realize that the next council could be full of young, inexperienced people. You need an old veteran like me to come in and make sure that it stays on track. And so that theme also emerged during last night's debate. Mm-hmm. Of course, Becca, another major issue in the city of Cincinnati and Hamilton County overall, and really across the country, is affordable housing and mm-hmm. access to it. And of course, there's been a lot of conversation about the lack of access to affordable housing in the county, in the city specifically. A ballot issue failed back in the primary overwhelmingly that would have mandated $50 million a year from the city to fund affordable housing opportunities. The candidates for mayor, David Mann and Aftab Pierwall, were asked about affordable housing last night and what their plan might be. Let's hear Aftab Pierwall's response, Josh.
Unfortunately, right now, our city leaders don't have a comprehensive plan for affordable housing, and I see it every single day. I see the disastrous effects of that every single day in eviction court, where people in the middle of a pandemic are being evicted. And back to the first question, oh, by the way, we are disproportionately evicting Black mothers. This is a challenge. In order to fund the trust fund, we've got to prioritize public-private partnerships, working collaboratively with all of our stakeholders, our universities, our hospitals, to make sure that we make a real commitment to fund the trust fund. But there are so many other strategies that don't cost any money, like reforming our tax abatement program. Right now, a vast majority of our tax incentives are concentrated in the three wealthiest neighborhoods at the expense of neighborhoods like Price Hill and Bond Hill. Right now, our zoning code. We've got to reform our zoning code because it's from an antiquated era and it prevents multifamily units from being built and it has strict parking requirements. Those are issues that are holding us back from increasing supply, and also they don't cost any money.
That was candidate Aftab Pierwall, the current Hamilton County Clerk of Courts, running for Cincinnati mayor. His opponent is Cincinnati City Councilman David Mann. And let's hear David Mann's response to the same question about affordable housing.
I've been one of the leaders on city council the last 4 years to address the problem of affordable housing. It was my legislation that created the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. It was my legislation that created a dedicated stream of income, the tax on short-term rentals, Airbnbs. And during the pandemic, that did not produce much revenue. But we just learned last week that for the first month of the current fiscal year, beginning July 1, 1 month, it generated $200,000 dedicated to the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. In the budget that we adopted this year, we set aside $19 million for Affordable Housing Trust Fund initiative. Some of it goes to the port. Others goes to other activities within the city, within the community. Recently, at the request and recommendation of the city manager, we created a housing advisory board that includes some really top-notch people. Former mayor, Vice Mayor Roxanne Qualls is one of the leaders of the group. Greg Glansman has been appointed. This group is being asked to create an effective, doable plan to bring more affordable housing to our city. We have borrowed $34 million from the HUD to create a revolving loan fund. We've asked the Cincinnati Development Fund to manage that for us, so we're making progress. So I think that we're in a very good place. We have a lot to do. And we have to include private partners. We have to improve the private sector, financial partners, and the like.
Again, that was Councilman David Mann responding to a question about affordable housing. So, Becca, we saw that this was a debate that broadcast on live television on Channel 48, WCET. It also broadcast live on our air, 91.7, at 7 o'clock last night. It was supposed to be on Facebook, and I guess there was a technical issue that prevented the broadcast from simulcasting onto the Facebook streams of the chamber and the TV and radio stations. But is there a place somewhere that people can find this now if they missed it last night so that they can listen to the answers and the context in their entirety?
Yep, absolutely. Actually, right before we went on the air here, we added that video to our website. So if you go to WVXU.org, you can find that video and a bit of the analysis of the debate. You can also find it on the CET website.
Okay. And so again, I was the moderator of this thing, but you were on the panel and you were asking questions of these candidates. And you had a question about community engagement. Tell us what that was.
So there... I will just say, as a reporter, I think community engagement is one of the top issues that I see when I talk to constituents and voters, that they – I think people often feel like there's always more the city can do on engagement. It's a little bit interesting because about a month ago, City Council did pass an ordinance requiring the development of a new citizen engagement policy, something that was attempted about 6 years ago and was never implemented, leading to some frustration. The answers to that question, I think, were pretty typical of other answers, with David Mann saying, you know, we are making progress on that. We're on the right track. And Aftab Pirbal saying, you know, there's more that can be done. I will say that's an issue that I haven't heard brought up much in this campaign so far. And I think we got a much less, I'll say, polished response from the Pirbal campaign on that one. You know, not a lot of specifics
got
there.
Got some clips from both of the candidates and their response to your question about that. We'll start with Councilman David Mann's response.
Well, let's talk about what citizen engagement and community engagement really means. When the city decides to do anything that impacts a neighborhood or a interest, a stakeholder interest in our city, for us to make good policy, we have to engage with those that might be concerned. And I've spent my career at City Hall devoting much time engaging with neighborhood community groups, neighborhood leaders, and the like. Last term, I was chair of the Neighborhoods Committee. We put more money into supporting community councils than we had in a long time. Just as an example, when FC Cincinnati, just across the street, was constructed, it came with a lot of engagement that I required before council voted to support FC Cincinnati. There was a weekend negotiation between FC Cincinnati and the West End Community Council with an attorney that I required FC Cincinnati to provide. And because of that, the West End got particular valuable benefits for citizens, for its youth, and for its businesses. That's real community engagement.
That was Councilman David Mann responding to Becca Costello's question about community engagement. Let's hear from his opponent, Hamilton County Clerk of Courts Aftab Pirbal.
I think there's a lot of room for improvement for the city to engage in more community engagement. Look, the pandemic has made it difficult for all of us to engage in person, for all of us to chat and to connect. But it's also ushered in a lot of innovation, whether it's FaceTime or Zoom. There's a lot of tools now at the city's disposal to engage with citizens, no matter whether they can leave their homes or not. I would mean to prioritize that kind of innovation and use those formats to engage more with the community, not less. I'm really proud of the fact that my track record as the clerk of courts shows you that I'm really committed to community engagement. I'm proud of the fact that when I'm in a neighborhood knocking on doors or at a church festival or at an event at a community organization, it's rarely the first time that I'm there. Because I believe the best way for our leaders to understand the challenges of our citizens, the hopes and dreams of our citizens, is to go out there and meet them. City Hall is a beautiful building, but it looks like a fortress. You got to go through metal detectors to actually talk to your public servants. I want to be the kind of mayor that is out there in the community, not hiding away in City Hall.
Again, you can hear this full debate at WVXU.org or watch it at WCET's website. Again, this was Thursday night featuring Aftab Pirbal and David Mann, the candidates for Cincinnati mayor. Becca Costello from right here at WVXU is with us. And before we let you run, Becca, what's next for these campaigns? There's not a lot of time left, a little over a week, I guess about a week and a half before Election Day and this thing is over. What do they have planned? Are there any other get-togethers?
It's a great question. I think really what this boils down to is I think we're already seeing early voting turnout is not significantly higher or really much different at all than other municipal elections. David Mann described this as the most important election of his memory, but it's still a municipal election. And I think the biggest challenge is going to be encouraging folks to get out and vote at all. And that's going to be kind of one of the biggest challenges. But as you said, not a lot of time left. So it'll be interesting to see how they try to energize those voters in the last week and a half.
Becca Costello at WVXU.org. Read and listen to her reporting there. Becca, thanks for being with us. I hope you have a great weekend. You've earned it.
Thanks, Michael. You too.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A local woman is helping the homeless because she's been there herself. And a local author's book, Dear White Friend, is having an impact on some government leaders here. WCPO reporter Lucy May joins us now on the phone. Lucy, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Thanks for having me, Michael. Go Eagles.
Absolutely. Although, I guess you're referencing we're both proud graduates of Scott High School. They got a thumping last night on the football field at the hands of the Holmes Bulldogs, 40-0 in a very important district game, but that's all right.
Aw, Eagles.
We are here to talk about a couple of lovely stories that you published this week, and I want to start with the first one. It's this book called Dear White Friend. Tell me about Mel Gravely, the author of this.
Mel Gravely is a local businessman and civic leader. I've known him for, I know, more than 20 years. I'm getting older by the minute, so I can't even remember how long ago I first met him. But he, right now, is the CEO and majority owner of Triversity Construction. He has written a number of books. He's been a civic leader and served on a bunch of boards and commissions and all kinds of stuff. And he's written, this is his ninth book. He decided several of his books have kind of touched on race in different ways. He wrote a book a number of years ago, for example, called When Black and White Make Green, which told the story of the creation of the Minority Business Accelerator at the Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. So he's written a little bit about race, but this book, Dear White Friend, really addresses the topic head on in a way that I think is really very approachable for people.
The title, Dear White Friend, makes it sound like it's a letter, and that's because in a lot of ways it is, right?
Yes, actually, every chapter is a letter. As my colleague Jay Warren and I sat down to talk to Mel about the book, he explained that he started writing these letters in late 2019. He had attended some racial equity training that was sponsored by the Greater Cincinnati Foundation. His head was just kind of spinning with everything he had learned. He was kind of unnerved by the political climate and how contentious everything in the country was. And he thought, I just need to write these letters to kind of get it out of my system. And he said after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia, he decided this has to be a book. And every chapter of the book is a letter that is written to an unnamed white friend. The title is very sincere. It's not designed to be sarcastic. I think in the context of race, some people might maybe take it the wrong way. But Mel has a lot of very close white friends, and this is a sincere and earnest attempt to kind of help them understand his perspective as a black person.
And it's really designed to help change the way that we talk about race. And this story is not just a profile. The story that you wrote, Lucy May, at WCPO, is not just about Mel Gravely and his book. It is about its book in practice. And it features two local government leaders who have been on this program separately and together, Joyce Paldrill, the village manager in Lincoln Heights, and Tom Carroll, the village manager in Silverton. And they've become friends, and this book has become a part of their relationship. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yes, this was really interesting to me. Joyce Paldrill, as you mentioned, is the village manager in Lincoln Heights. When she took that job, Tom Carroll was one of the very first people to reach out to her and say, hey, this is the first time Joyce has been a village manager. She's got a huge depth of experience in many areas. But Tom said, hey, if there's anything I can do to help, he had been helping the village write a grant to improve an athletic complex there. He said, I can continue to help with that project, but I'd be happy to help you any way I can. They quickly developed a very close and trusting friendship, and Joyce knows Mel. She has known him for years, and when she heard about this book, she knew right away that she wanted to get two copies, one for herself and one for Tom. And she said that they already, in their friendship, had the ability to talk about very tough subjects, to talk about race in a very direct and frank way. They have a deal that, hey, we can talk about anything. Neither one of us are going to get offended by questions or missteps or anything like that. But this book, they both read it, and it really did open some additional conversation and understanding between them. And they both, as Joyce put it, it's only served to strengthen their friendship.
We should note that Tom Carroll, the village manager in Silverton, is a white man, and Joyce Paldrill, the village manager in Lincoln Heights, is a black woman. How else is this book being used by local organizations and leaders? I understand that the home builders are also turning to Gravely for assistance in leading these conversations.
Yes, the Home Builders Association of Greater Cincinnati had a meet and greet with Mel Thursday evening at Switch Lighting and Design downtown. Bertie Ray, who owns Switch, is a member of the association, and he reached out to T.J. Ackerman, who's the president of the association, and said, hey, I think, you know, it could really benefit our members to do this meet and greet as part of a diversity, equity, and inclusion committee that the Home Builders Association has. So they had, you know, room for 65 people to kind of meet Mel Gravely, talk about the book, talk about some really tough issues. I'll be honest with you, I've been running around like a chicken with my head cut off, so I don't know if they sold out last night or not, but I know that T.J. Ackerman was really excited to be hosting the conversation. He said he hopes it's just one of many that his organization can have. Mel told me, and this wasn't really featured in the story, but he told me that his publisher has sold copies of this book sometimes by the hundreds, because there are organizations that want to get copies for all of their members or all of their employees or for, you know, a point of discussion. So he hopes that it's going to really change the way people across the country talk about race. And as he put it, he hopes it's an on-ramp for some people who are uncomfortable about the conversation, for some white people who feel like anytime race comes up, they're being accused of being racist. He hopes it's an on-ramp for them to get a little bit better understanding in a way that doesn't feel quite as threatening as it can to some people.
And the book is called Dear White Friend. It's written by Mel Gravely and is now available in bookstores and online. We're talking to Lucy May, a reporter from WCPO. Another story you had out this week of great interest to people who like uplifting tales is about a woman named Miranda Hurd. And she is someone who has turned a lot of her time to assisting the homeless because she knows what that experience is like. Tell us about her.
Yes, well, this is one of our, we have a feature on WCPO called Acts of Kindness that my talented colleague Kristen Hartman started during the pandemic when we all needed some uplifting stories about people doing things out of the goodness of their heart because, you know, it's been kind of a mess since the onslaught of the pandemic. But I get to do these now once a week. They've quickly become some of my favorite stories to do. And Santa Maria Community Services, a nonprofit that serves communities in Price Hill, reached out to me and said, hey, we just had this lady drop off all these boxes of food. We just met her. She's got this really inspiring story. And I met Miranda. She is a force of nature. She experienced homelessness herself for several years when she lived in California and got help from a couple of nonprofit organizations in Los Angeles. She was kind of staying in a shelter in the Skid Row area of Los Angeles that probably a lot of folks have heard of. And she came back to Cincinnati. And once she got back on her feet, she thought, you know, I really want to give back. I want to help others. And since the start of this year, once a month, she's been using money from her paychecks to buy the food that she needs to pack lunches, bagged lunches, that she then delivers to people experiencing homelessness. She drives around. She'd been making 50 lunches, but when my colleague Jay Warren and I interviewed her, she said, I ran out. So she was making enough chicken salad for 100 lunches the day that we talked with her. And she just really, she's got a nonprofit organization that she started. She doesn't have tax-exempt status, so she hasn't been able to give people tax breaks for donations and hasn't really gotten a whole lot of donations, but really feels like it's important to give back and kind of walk the walk. And she said when people kind of are in shock that she spends her own money on this, what she tells them is, this is not my money, it's the Lord's money. And if I don't use it to help his children, I won't have it for long. So she's a very religious person, a person of great faith, and is you know, doing this work just because she thinks it's the right thing to do, and just a really fun person to meet.
Well, we know that, you know, from your reporting that she is using her own funds, and it's very noble, and I think people can certainly appreciate her reasoning behind that. It does look like she's hoping to sell T-shirts and other items to raise money for her work, but I mean, my goodness, this is someone who could very easily run out of money feeding this many mouths. It's hard enough for families to feed each other in some occasions. So what are her plans to, I guess, find a sustainable way to maintain this good work she's doing?
Well, she believes that the Lord will provide. She said she's going. She does have, as you said, a plan to sell T-shirts and some other things that she's having kind of made and designed to support her work. We included in our in the story an email address for her, and I actually did have a couple people reach out to me afterwards and say, hey, I really want to help her. I want to send some money her way to help with this mission. She does hope one day to get a 501c status so that she can get donations in a bigger way and seek corporate donations and donations from individuals who would like to be able to make a tax-exempt donation to the organization. So she has plans and dreams, but she needs somebody to kind of help her with that. But she thinks that when the time is right, so that person will appear in her path and it'll all come together.
Lucy May is a reporter at WCPO, often full of wonderful moving tales and important tales like those. You can read them at WCPO.com and see them on Channel 9. Lucy May, I'm sure I'll see you power walking around town soon.
I hope to see you kickboxing in your window.
Me too. It's always a pleasure running to you downtown. Thanks for spending some time with us today, Lucy.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
And 17 curious Cincinnati dogs, the purpose of the city's first Columbus Day celebration, and a time when the common cold here was treated with smoking. We've got local historian and writer Greg Hand with us next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We wrap our weekly news review now with Cincinnati Magazine contributor and the author of Cincinnati Curiosities and local historian, Greg Hand. Greg, thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon. Always a pleasure.
It is always a pleasure to read your work, and it's one of the reasons I'm glad you're retired from your main day job, because you just dig up the best stuff, and it just reminds us all of how colorful the city has always been. And I want you to take us back to a period when the best cure for the cold was smoking. It kind of reminds me of old cigarette ads where doctors were encouraging you to pick up the habit.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. This is a situation where back in the day, what you did was you treated symptoms. You treated symptoms. And so when you find advertisements, and there were always advertisements for catarrh, the dread catarrh, they tended to be the sorts of things that irritated your mucous membranes, because with that irritation, you had the feeling that something was working. And so one of the things that you did was you burned these volatile substances, these very spicy substances. The one in particular was a type of pepper known as cubeb, and inhaled it. And it probably burned like hell, but because it burned it, you thought it was working.
And that's so interesting. And I guess we should point out, because when I first read the headline, I was very confused, but these aren't tobacco cigarettes.
Although there were a number of recommendations for actual tobacco cigars, more than cigarettes, to be used for certain respiratory problems. Some women were advised, for instance, to smoke a good stogie before they went to bed to alleviate nighttime breathing problems.
Oh, those were the days, I bet. But one of the challenges of pushing smoking to address colds, it looks like it led to something that we would experience now. What you don't want is for younger people to pick up the habit, according to health organizations, certainly, and parents too, probably. But you do include in this report at Cincinnati Magazine about the best cure for colds being smoking back then. Was that little boys were intrigued by this too, right? I mean, maybe this was something that made them feel older and stronger.
It was a gateway gateway situation, both for young juvenile delinquents, a situation that was brought up in the musical, The Music Man, where Professor Hill is warning the citizens of River City about their juvenile delinquent children hanging out at the pool room, smoking cubebs.
Which was on
the way to real cigarettes, but it was also a gateway and in a sense, kind of a step in women's liberation for women, that women could smoke these medicinal cigarettes, and their husbands got used to seeing their wives smoking something. And when they switched over to actual cigarettes, it was kind of no big deal. So what was the old cigarette advertisement? You've come a long way, baby.
Oh, yeah, that was Virginia Slims.
That started out with these medicinal cigarettes.
Oh, my goodness. Now, when we think of being young and having cold symptoms, perhaps we remember Vicks VapoRub. And based on your reporting here, I mean, the Cubeb was one of the original ingredients in this?
That's right. You know, it's a good thing I don't have a blog that specializes in the history of medical treatments, because these manufacturers have not only changed the ingredients themselves, but when they want to act like they have something new, they change the name of an ingredient they've always used. So I have no idea at the present whether Cubeb, that sort of pepper, is still used in Vicks VapoRub, but in the original formulation, that was in fact one of the ingredients that you were instructed to rub on your child's chest to open up the breathing passages.
We're talking with local historian Greg Hand. You can read his writings in Cincinnati Magazine and online at the Cincinnati Magazine website, and also in his blog, Cincinnati Curiosities, which I encourage you to search for online and read every day. There's fun stuff that he posts there. I want you to talk about Columbus Day now. This was something that just passed recently, and of course, the conversation around that longtime federal holiday is being recharacterized as Indigenous Peoples Day because of the brutality that Columbus and people like him put upon the natives of the land that he stumbled upon back in the 1490s. And take us back to the first time that Columbus Day was recognized in Cincinnati, because this was important for Italians who were discriminated against.
Yes. Many years ago, I went to talk to a historian on the faculty at the University of Cincinnati, a guy named Jim Laux. And the big takeaway I had from his conversation was to always remember the pastness of the past, that you can't go back into the past with the glasses that you use for contemporary situations. And so while watching this debate over Columbus Day and the characterization of Columbus as an imperialist and a slave trader and all the things which he actually was, it is forgotten that this was a rare opportunity in the 1890s for Italian immigrants in the United States to have just a brief opportunity to gain some respect, because they were so mistreated. And in fact, one of the impetuses for the initial celebration of Columbus Day was a situation in which 11 Italian immigrants were lynched. Oh. In New Orleans, in the wake of the assassination of the police chief of that city.
What can you tell us about the Italian population in Cincinnati in that period? Was it large?
No, the Cincinnati, we're talking about in the 1890s, and Cincinnati had some Italian residents. But really, the Italian population hadn't migrated very much from the coasts at that time. And in fact, Cincinnati was trying to get together something to celebrate Columbus Day. And in fact, you know, Cincinnati's initial celebration in 1892, marking the 400th anniversary of Columbus's landing, was unabashedly imperialistic. I mean, the whole celebration was, you know, this is the anniversary of the day that we started killing all these bothersome Indians who were taking up our natural-born land. And some Italians of relatively high social standing, a doctor and a hotel manager, for instance, participated in the planning. But there really weren't a lot of Italians to actually participate in the celebration.
I thought it was interesting, as you noted just moments ago, that newspapers of the period reported on folks who were opposed to Columbus Day. I just found that so surprising that the conversation that we're having around that date and this historic figure now is really not new. You quote the Post, which reported on October 25th of 18...
And that opposition did not come from some enlightened sense of social responsibility. It was largely religious prejudice that inspired the disagreement about honoring Columbus. The opposition tended to be Protestants who objected to Columbus specifically because these Italians who were looking to honor Columbus were Catholic. And the division between Catholics and the Protestant population in Cincinnati was so extreme that when Cincinnati finally did get around to organizing its celebration, they separated the Catholics and the Protestants on different days.
Oh my gosh.
So the Catholic schools paraded on one day, and then the next day the public school children, so that they would not intermingle and share this insidious papist propaganda.
Yeah, there was a group of ministers from Louisville that were reported on by the Post on October 25, 1892. You include this quote in the reporting from this newspaper. Ministers here are quarreling about the Columbus Day celebration. Reverend McCamey of the First Cumberland Presbyterian Church denounced Columbus from the pulpit as a liar, a pirate, an associate of lewd women, a slave trader, a deserter of his wife, and a man utterly without one Christian principle. He said he was not led to discovery through an interest in science, but a sordid love for gold, and this hero worship was out of place. So read that reporting from Greg Hand, Cincinnati Magazine. Again, you can find his blog, Cincinnati Curiosities, online. Before we let you run, Greg, we want to talk about something that I know public radio listeners adore, and that's dogs. And you have compiled 17, quote, curious and occasionally famous Cincinnati dogs. Why don't you pick a few of these out and tell us why they matter?
Well, one of my favorites is Miles Duffy. Back in the days in the late 60s, I was an unabashed fanboy of the Jelly Pudding Show on WEBN, and was one of these folks who made the pilgrimage to the blue house with the barber chair on the front porch on Considine Avenue in Price Hill, and was able to actually see the dog dish labeled Miles that Frank Wood Sr., when he started the radio station, did not have enough staff to fill in all of the lines on the FCC forms. And so he nominated his dog as the program manager. And for years, Miles Duffy was credited as the program manager for WEBN. So that's my absolute favorite.
Oh, that's great. That station has such an interesting history with animals. And I mean, it's, you know, the frog, of course. And Miles was a Cocker Spaniel. You do note that, I mean, maybe Miles, while long dead, is possibly still on this earthly terrain, right? He was taxidermied.
He was taxidermied, and I know that somewhere I've heard of somewhere there is a WEBN archive, and I certainly hope at some point Miles is donated, for instance, to the museum center where he can appropriately be put on display. for Cincinnatians to think about their canine history.
Which of these dogs with Cincinnati connections do you think had the most widespread renown?
Oh, it's got to be Marge Schott's Big St. Bernards.
Shotzi and Shotzi 2.
Shotzi and Shotzi 02. Marge was just relentless in her promotion of these dogs, to the point that the groundskeepers had to make special trips around the field before each game to clean up the dog poop, and and she would pull hair off the dogs and send them to whoever was the manager at the time with instructions to rub it on your chest for good luck and that sort of thing. So that was clearly the most famous.
I once got Marge Schott's autograph as a child, and she also signed Shotzi and drew a little paw on it.
Right,
so I think that was a common thing. One more before you run, Greg, and this is really, really interesting one. Take us back to around 1858. I don't even know how to pronounce this dog's name. It had some weird defect, or curiosity, I should say. Lucius Naturae?
Oh, yeah. That's Latin. That is Latin for a freak of nature.
Oh, goodness.
And Lucius Naturae.
There you go.
And
that's a good Catholic boy.
And this is a key point in the history of Cincinnati. One of the aspects of researching dog history in Cincinnati is you see a gradual evolution of more kindness. Here was this dog, and it was born with an extra head on the end of one of its feet. And that in itself was kind of unusual, that you'd have a dog born like that. But at the end of the story, it says, yeah, the owner of the dog that gave birth to this freak hired a kid to take the dog out and drown it in the canal. And that was kind of standard. You know, nobody went to veterinarians. Nobody had their dog put to sleep. You know, if your dog got old and that sort of thing, you'd leave it outside to die, or you'd hit it in the head with a rock, or something like that. And this story about taking it out to drown in the canal, you know, kind of marks a point in a progression that later on you see another freak dog born, this time with five legs. And there's no talk about killing it. There's a lot of effort made to find a good home for it, somebody who's going to take care of this freakish little dog. And it's a sign that over the years, Cincinnati did become a nicer place.
Indeed it has. And Greg Hand is always there to profile it. You can read his writing in Cincinnati Magazine and online at Cincinnati Curiosities. Greg, thanks for spending time with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Another story that came out this week at WVXU.org is that I will be leaving Cincinnati Edition, and I'm very sad about that, but another opportunity has emerged. You can read about that at WVXU.org. I want you to know that I will be here through December 17 hosting this program, and the show will remain in good hands thanks to our producer, Selena Reeder, our assistant producer, Nick Swartzel, our technical director, Josh Elstrow. Again, read more about that at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We've made it to Friday. I hope you have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.